Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, my God is awesome. Welcome, welcome. You're listening to the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show with your host, Reverend Alethea Smith Withers, pastor of the Pavilion of God in Washington, D.C. The Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show is a Keeping It Real show about life. I minister to the people of God through all phases of their experience, even up to the higher life of the spirit. Tonight, my guest is the Reverend Madison Shockley, a man with great humility and a prophetic voice that will help us all to rev up, accelerate, and energize our thinking. Our topic this evening is Ferguson, Missouri, and how faith leaders around the country are praying and analyzing. I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Some of us are still brim with turkey and all of the things that go along with turkey and Thanksgiving. The Pavilion of God gave away 286 Thanksgiving baskets, each with a turkey and greens and string beans and cranberries and sweet potatoes and white potatoes and rice, and the list goes on and on. And we were thankful to have this opportunity to give away so many Thanksgiving baskets to people who really needed them and would appreciate this way to celebrate Thanksgiving. My prayer is that everyone who was a recipient of the Thanksgiving baskets had a joyful Thanksgiving and that they had plenty of leftovers to continue to enjoy for a few days yet. Sunday, this past Sunday, December 30th, was the beginning of November 30th was the beginning of the Advent season. Some of us are very familiar with Advent, but I think I can explain it very simply. Advent means coming, and it's the way that many Christians prepare themselves for the coming of Christ and the birth of Jesus. And each week we celebrate a different value that will help us really be focused and our hearts prepared for the blessed event of the birth of Jesus. And the first week of Advent, we focus on hope. And so this week we're talking about hope. We're looking at biblical reasons for hope, theological reasons for hope, and we're hoping to be inspired by a new and fresh understanding of hope. Also, just kind of thinking about the things that have occurred since our last show, December 1st was World AIDS Day. It was a time of remembrance and awareness of the challenges of AIDS, HIV and AIDS, and it was a real invitation for us to be mindful, prayerful, compassionate, supportive, and loving to ourselves and others. So many of us, all of us, I have, and I'm sure you have in some way, have been touched by AIDS, maybe a family member, friend, or maybe yourself. But we stand together as a community to fight and prevent AIDS, fight against AIDS, and certainly to prevent AIDS and to work for a cure for AIDS. So be prayerful about AIDS. For those of you who are in the metropolitan, Washington metropolitan area, or who will be visiting the this area in the near future, I want to let you know that the Pavilion of God is the Baptist congregation in the nation's capital, and we worship at 6401 Chilham Place Northwest. Our worship service and Sunday school for children are on Sunday at 12:30 p.m. We have a Christmas pageant coming up on December 21st, so if you're in the area, join us for a joyful Christmas pageant during our worship hour. Wednesday is our prayer line. So tomorrow we have a prayer phone prayer line, and I invite you to call us at 6 a.m. or 12 noon. Dial 605-475-4333. Let me give you that number again. It's 605-475-4333. Access code is 213-781. It's a joyful thing to engage in prayer and share prayer time with other faithful people. So consider giving us a call, and we'll be happy to pray with and for you. On Thursdays, we have Bible study at 6:30. We're focusing our study on hearing the voice of God. That is at our church at 6401 Chilham Place Northwest. Please feel free to contact me by dialing 202-365-2842, or certainly email me at revalethea@gmail.com. You can always tweet me at revalethea or connect with me on Instagram. Also, look at our Facebook page, Pavilion of God Facebook page. Keep up with inspiration daily and information about our ministries. Our church motto is Mission Possible, Mission Possible. And that is to remind us that with God, all things are possible. I invite you right now to open your hearts and open your minds as I share a word of prayer. Almighty, invisible, God, only wise, we invite you, O Lord, to come to this place that exists in time and space, and come even into our hearts and our minds. Enable us to pause and think and rethink who we are and whose we are. O Lord, empower us to embrace again our purpose and your promise. For you have said, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these. O Lord, we thank you for your words, for your word encourages us. You've taught us that we can do greater things. And we faithfully seek the greater things, O God, the blessings and the gifts given to us so that we might embrace life brilliantly and completely. O Lord, let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. This is our prayer, O God. Empower us to rev up, accelerate, and energize our living. It is in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen and amen. Hallelujah. This is a good evening. If you're just joining us, welcome to the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show, with your host, Reverend Alethea Smith-Withers. And tonight, my guest is Madison Shockley. To join the dialogue, dial 347-945-7723. Also, you can write a comment on the blog site for me, and others to see, and I will certainly share the comments with our guests and your questions with our guests. Tonight we're talking about the United States through the lens of all that has happened and is happening in Ferguson, Missouri. That's so much, and it's a big picture and a major challenge. To help us with this complex and complicated discussion, we have our guest, the Reverend Madison Shockley, pastor of the Pilgrim United Church of Christ in Carlsbad, California. Along with performing pastoral duties with Pilgrim United Church of Christ, Madison serves on the board of directors of American Civil Liberties Union of San Diego and Imperial Counties, and the board of directors of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. He also writes commentary for various online and print outlets. He's also a husband and follower, and I'm proud and delighted to call him my friend. And I think I have him on the line. Good evening. Is this Matt?
Yes, Alethea, my friend. Thank you very much for having me on your show tonight.
Oh, absolutely. Welcome to the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show. I have wanted to have an opportunity to have you on the show, but I am sad to say that this is the occasion that we're talking about all of the challenges we face since August. And
yes.
But I truly appreciate the fact that you come to this with great thought and consideration. And I'm hoping that a couple of other ministers may join us on the line this evening, among them Bishop John Selders. So when he comes on, I'll certainly be able to let you know. I don't know, Madison. This is such a huge picture, and I want to talk about everything. And let's start not even with something that you've referred to in your articles. Can you share just a little bit about what you thought, how you felt when you heard? When you first heard about the tragic killing of Michael Brown?
Oh, yes. That I'm sure it was one of those moments for all of us, like, where were you when you heard the news? And
yeah.
It was devastating, of course, from the perspective that the first reports, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but the first reports were consistently that Michael Brown, A, was unarmed, 2, was being shot at as he ran away, 3, was shot dead while surrendering. And, you know, with that set of facts, it was the utter and total frustration of, you know, what does a black man have to do? It just had reached an absurdity that we can't even surrender, that it's simply their prerogative to shoot and kill as they see fit. And, of course, the verdict validated this officer's decisions to shoot Michael Brown to death in the middle of the street, unarmed as he was. And, of course, following on the Trayvon Martin killing, where he also was unarmed, it just boggles the mind as to, you know, what must we do to live free in this country and not be subject to, you know, just capricious and random killing by civilian and police officer alike.
Yeah, you know, it's startling, it's confusing, it is painful, it is enraging. I think most of us went through a combination of all of those emotions, and it was a flood of emotions.
Yeah.
Immediately. You know, the most, I think, as a parent, the statement in one of your articles that just totally I mean, have you ever read something and you just continue to read that one sentence over and over again? That's how I got stuck on the article that you wrote for the Huffington Post. And I'll just read it for the audience. You said, "I don't know what to tell my 27-year-old son to do when the police next accost him."
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with that because it is the story of not what do I tell my son when and if the police accost him, but when they next accost him. And it was so real for me. And, you know, my many of my friends who are not African American are still still very surprised that this is a real daily occurrence for an upstanding African American male. My son was stopped by the police at gunpoint on Metro in Washington, D.C. when he was a 10th grader in school.
Wow.
And, you know, the idea that your child can be stopped while sitting on a Metro, literally doing nothing, and is the most conservative young man at now and then, and shouldn't be judged if he wasn't a conservative person, but literally he was toeing the line, short haircut, pants on his waist, everything, and speaking. I mean, he didn't have an opportunity to speak or to demonstrate knowledge or anything. And again, these are not factors that should matter.
Right.
But he was stopped at gunpoint and pulled off the Metro. And so that was just one of many, and that was when he was in 10th grade and now a man. So what on earth do you say to your son?
Well, this, like I said in the article, this case just really baffles me. And I said, do I just tell him to keep on running? You know, was Michael Brown's mistake turned around and stopped in compliance with the orders to stop? Maybe he should have just kept running. You know, maybe he'd still be alive. You know, by that time, you know, obviously the officer was a pretty bad shot. You know, that's why I missed him several times. And he also missed him because he was shooting at him from such a distance with a pistol. And so, you know, I think that physical evidence, you know, demonstrates that, you know, he was shooting at him as he was running away and from a great distance, too great a distance for Michael Brown to be considered a threat. And, you know, with the validation of his tactic in shooting him in this way, I say, what do I tell my son? What do I do myself? What do I do myself? And, it's interesting because if you recall, I don't know the name, but I think you'll remember the occasion when the woman and a male companion and two children were pulled over for a seatbelt violation. And the police officers wound up breaking the window, tasing the man in the passenger seat who had done nothing wrong. And she had called 911 while they were being stopped because they were afraid to get out of the car because the police officers are liable to do anything. And so she wanted more officers on site. She wanted, you know, more observation of how they were being handled because she didn't trust what they were going to do. And so in that case, pulled him out of the car. So it really is a moment where Black America has to say, you know, we've taught our children be cooperative. We taught our children, you know, be polite. Those things don't work. They don't work. And now with this case, they've been given license to shoot to kill upon their own suspicion, but not upon their own suspicion, upon their own fear for their safety.
Yes.
And that subjective criteria is deadly to us. Because when they look at Michael Brown, they see this demon. But, of course, when you look at your son or I look at my son, we see a teenager.
Yeah.
And so that's why we need police officers from the African-American community policing the African-American community, because they won't see demons and Hulk Hogan. They'll see their little boys and their kids and the ones they coach at Pop Warner and the ones that, you know, are dating their daughters in high school. They will see them as human beings.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But because this country considers it legitimate for Darren Wilson to look at this young man and decide he's a monster, and then therefore he has the right to shoot him.
Right, and be able to speak it. I don't think he actually even heard the power of his words comparing him to Hulk Hogan. I mean, he doesn't understand the impact and all that that is, how telling those words are.
The best comment on that was in the Guardian newspaper in London. Their headline read, "Darren Wilson, the world's first 6'4", 210-pound, 5-year-old. Now, isn't it interesting? We have known from day one how tall and how heavy Michael Brown was. For the first time in these 5 months or however long it's been since August, the first time that we heard how tall and large Darren Wilson was when the transcripts came out. Why was that? That information should have been disclosed with his name at that first press conference when the police chief stood there in the city trying to disparage Michael Brown rather than identifying the officer that killed him.
It's amazing. I'm also struck by how conflicted we are as African Americans. We understand that our sons and daughters are entitled to protection and to justice as they walk the streets within this country, and yet some of us have quickly, got to a place of trying to determine whether he had done something wrong. And, when I stopped them immediately, because even if he had done something wrong, he was entitled to life.
Yes.
And
he had committed no capital offense.
No, he hadn't. He hadn't. And I must admit, I appreciate it. I'm encouraging the audience to see on the blog site the articles that Reverend Madison has written, because you did a good job, Madison, and a helpful job, not just good, but a helpful job of helping us process what the issues were and are.
Here's one of the things it's very difficult to do at times. One of the things I do in the truthdig.com article is, being as generous as one can, even to Darren Wilson. He had several legal courses of action that he could have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And at every turn, he chose the most lethal option. And, a case has already been made that what he did was legal. Still doesn't make it right, and it still doesn't mean that was his only legal option.
Talk about the two mistakes that you saw that the police officer made. I mean, the glaring mistake.
Well, the number one is he called for backup, but then didn't wait for backup.
Mm-hmm.
If he had simply waited for his backup, 90 seconds is all that separated that call for backup from the death of Michael Brown. If he had waited 90 seconds, now remember, as they keep describing this 6'4", 292-pound 10-year-old, how fast was he running? I'm sorry. he wasn't going to get very far. And, in fact, I suppose that part of the reason he turned around is he got tired of running after about a 60-yard dash. All he had to do was wait for his backup, because every police, the experts that I've talked to has had conferences with other police officers. And to a person, they say his tactical mistake was getting out of the car to be immediately outnumbered by those he was pursuing. That's simply a tactical error. He pulled up his car to these two people too close to be even able to open his door. Again, just error after error. And then the other option he could have taken, because when, again, they asked him, I don't even know if they asked him in the transcripts, I have to read them more carefully, because They did not cross-examine Darren Wilson. But George Stephanopoulos asked him very gently the question, why didn't you stay in the car? And let him get away with this answer, I'm trained to pursue and blah, blah, blah. No, you're trained to apprehend. And as long as, and he said, I needed, you know, to keep the, now at this term, suspect in view, it would have been easier and safer to follow him in his car. You know, why would you get out of the car and expose yourself to danger when all you have to do is just drive your car? The guy was running down the street. It wasn't like
he
hopped the fence and went to the backyard.
Especially if it was true that Michael Brown accosted him. I mean, why would you get out of the car? I mean,
Well, a friend of mine said this, which I found stunning. He said the biggest lie that Darren Wilson told was that he was afraid of Michael Brown.
Mm-hmm.
That was the lie he needed to tell to justify his fear, to justify his shooting of Michael Brown. But none of his actions betrayed that he was afraid.
No, you don't
get out of the car if you just got whooped. You wait for your backup.
Absolutely.
He was embarrassed that this teenager had gotten the better of him when he tried to pull up alongside him and hassle him in the street. He was embarrassed, and he got out of the car to reassert his manhood. He didn't think that this guy was Hulk Hogan and he was a 5-year-old. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
He got out of the car to reassert his manhood over this teenager, and he knew that with a gun, he would not fail. Hand-to-hand combat in the car, he failed. And my police friends still say, you don't pull your gun out in the car. That's an opportunity for this attacker to use your gun against you.
Absolutely. And, you know, the question has to be, if he grabbed the gun, I can't imagine that Michael Brown would have been able, had the gun would have been taken from him. I you know, the whole scenario is bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I must admit, I question every aspect of the story. I think it's contrived.
Oh, not only contrived, here's the other thing. The police officer that interviewed him the night of the shooting did not record the interview and didn't bother to take notes. So we do not know if there is a inconsistency between his original account that night and the account that he testified to the grand jury 3 months later after all the physical evidence had been divulged.
Well, you know, and then we have the whole suspect, the fact that he turned his own gun in. I mean, I have watched enough detective shows and police shows to know that when there is a police-involved shooting, the gun is taken from that officer immediately.
At every step, the police department and the justice system have not only favored, they failed Michael Brown and the community, but they have at every step favored and protected Darren Wilson. And that includes the prosecutor and the grand jury. Now, the grand jury in this, I'm not blaming them. They were dupes. No one can find an example of where a grand jury was given every possible shred of evidence and non-evidence that a prosecutor could find. If this had gone to a preliminary hearing, the judge would have said, why are you bringing me these witnesses that you already know aren't telling the truth? And in fact, the role of a prosecutor is to present a theory of the case and to present probable cause to a grand jury or to a judge in a preliminary hearing so that they can conclude that there is sufficient evidence that a crime is committed, and you never have the defendant testify. It's simply not done. All of this was designed to obfuscate, confuse, and overwhelm the grand jury, turning them into a trial jury, which they were not designed to do.
You know, something that totally slipped me. I have read most of the transcripts, but until you said it, and I hope the audience caught it, that the person who is the defendant or potential defendant doesn't testify.
No, they're not even in the room. But here, the prosecutor became the defense attorney, and there was no prosecutor in the room. The whole thing was turned upside down. And then they had the nerve to say, well, you read the transcripts. Don't you see there's no evidence? No, this was totally upside down. The prosecutor became the defendant, and the grand jury became the trial jury. And so that's why the community has no confidence in the outcome of this process.
Well, I have a question that came in from one of my listeners just now. Can you just mention again, they're asking what's the purpose of the grand jury in terms of determining guilt? That's the question.
The role of the grand jury is not to determine guilt. The role of the grand jury is simply to determine whether a crime has been committed. Is there sufficient evidence that a crime has been committed?
Mm-hmm.
Not even who did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the prosecutor has then gotten an indictment that he has a potential suspect, but the evidence that a crime has been committed, then you charge this person with that crime. So to make it simple, there was $1 million in the bank. The money is now gone. The grand jury can conclude the bank was robbed.
Right.
You don't have a defendant come in and say, well, I didn't take it. You don't bring in random people off the street to say, I didn't see anybody steal it. And that's basically what this prosecutor did, brought in as many unfounded accounts to obscure what should have been a clear line theory of the crime. He would have presented those witnesses that supported the idea that a crime against Michael Brown, i.e. manslaughter or murder, had been committed. Period. The defense was their chance at trial. They waged the defense in the grand jury, which is never done, and certainly not done by the prosecutor. You've probably read more of the transcripts than I have, but the reports I've read said that the prosecutors consistently cross-examined any witness, especially the eyewitnesses, that contradicted Darren Wilson's account, and had no contradiction or no cross-examination of the witnesses that supported Darren Wilson's account, and then ultimately no cross-examination of Darren Wilson. All just bizarre.
It is bizarre. I mean, from the Hulk Hogan comments and to the witnesses that were questioned and they're changing their initial statements. I think that one of the disturbing comments that the officer made for me, I mean, it was extremely disturbing to me, was that he saw his demonic facial expression melt away into a blank stare. I mean, that was so disturbing on so many levels to me, I found myself wondering who coached him into.
Oh, absolutely! His entire testimony was contrived to fit the law, and so given that he had the opportunity to contrive his testimony, it's no wonder the grand jury didn't indict him. And my question about that was, how, if you in one breath say that all you saw was the top of his head and that was your target for the final shot, how do you see his top of his head and his face at the same time? But that's not a cross-examination that was had.
No.
And they left it to the grand jury to decide their own theory of the crime when that's not their job.
You know, I'm wondering, and you'll have to help me with this. You're a theologian, a pastor, a community leader. Why is it important for clergy in particular to know be aware of some of the information you have shared this evening? You know, not all of us necessarily need to read all the transcripts, but to be informed with articles such as you've written, the other newspaper articles. Why is that a critical concern at this time?
Well, it's very important that whether the only audience a pastor has is their congregation, and certainly if you have a larger audience of the community, you have a responsibility to bring the truth to light.
Amen.
That's our prophetic role, is to bring the truth to light and to help those who are oppressed find their freedom. And so part of our job is to determine, I'll borrow a phrase from the grand jury, that a crime was indeed committed, and that the oppression of the institutional racism of the Ferguson Police Department is real, and it has real consequences that we now see as the killing of Michael Brown. Now, here's another piece of information that should have been pursued that I haven't heard many people talk about in the media or otherwise. In the transcript that I read from Darren Wilson, he said that neighborhood is not well liked, and they don't like the police. Now, that's testimony that should have been clearly cross-examined. Why do you believe that is not a well-liked community? And what's not said, but it's implied, is not liked by the police, and they don't like the police. We don't like them, and they don't like us. That was Darren Wilson's mindset going into his daily patrol. No officer is fit to patrol a community if that is his opinion of the community.
Yes.
That was Darren Wilson's opinion, and he was speaking in the royal we. It's not well liked by us. And so for those who want to claim that this is not a racial issue, all they need is to read that statement by Darren Wilson. His us versus them framing of his daily job clearly shows that with a 90% white police force patrolling a 90% African-American community, you can't tell me that's not a racial situation.
Absolutely.
And he's admitted we didn't like them and they didn't like us.
What I also think is helpful, Madison, is that you have talked about in your article, and for those who haven't heard you preach or teach in other ways, you also are very helpful in making the connections from one isolated situation to a broader story. And in your article, you talk about Amadou Diallo.
Yes.
Of course, there are many other stories. I mean, that is, but I like the fact that you brought up, it's a perfect story. I mean, it's literally juries making decisions 14 years apart.
Well, it was odd to read my own words 14 years later as though someone else had written them. But you know, as I was writing this article, I said, wait a minute, I've been here before.
Yeah.
And I pulled up the article I wrote for the Los Angeles Times in 2000, and many of your listeners may not know about Amadou Diallo, but he was a African immigrant from Guinea who lived in New York, and he was simply going into his apartment building, and there was an undercover squad of police, so there were no police cars marked, no uniformed police. They were pursuing a rapist, and they had mistaken him for their suspect. We all look alike. And so as they were sneaking up on him, he may not even have, probably was not aware that they were even following him. He pulls out his wallet, and who knows why. Maybe he keeps his door key in his wallet. We'll never know. Pulls out his wallet, and they open fire and shot him. And they had a trial, and the jury found them not guilty, because they reasonably feared for their lives. He was struck 19 times.
Same language.
Hail of bullets. It's always the same language. If it's not whether they are actually in danger of their lives, only if they have a fear for their lives, and that fear does not need to be well-founded.
And
one
you know,
of the officers, as they were sneaking up the stairs, tripped and fell backward. And they thought he'd been shot. And that's when they unleashed all these bullets. And poor Amadou Diallo didn't even know he was being observed. Died at the scene. And so my conclusion in 2000 was, because that verdict, that that killing was legal, was right in the eyes of the law, we can count the days until it happened again.
And look
at that. We know how many dozens of times it's happened since 2000.
Absolutely.
And I was saying,
and most
shouldn't
of
protest.
Those we don't even hear about. Those are not written about.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I was saying that we shouldn't protest because the verdict was wrong. We should protest because the verdict was right. Because the verdict said it is right to kill a black man if you, as a police officer, fear him.
Okay, now you need to say that again, because I got it, but, you know, the verdict was right.
Yes.
Say that one more time, please.
We protested because we felt the verdict was wrong.
Yeah.
But we should have been protesting because the verdict was right, because it was legal to kill Amadou Diallo, because it was deemed legal to kill Michael Brown. We should be protesting because those verdicts are considered legal.
Yes.
That's what we have to change.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, and that's what clergy, what theologians, all of us should make clear what justice really is.
Yes, and
because we are not always sure, and because we simply say follow the law, and we don't understand that the law is not always just.
And we
need to find those arguments that make it plain, that empower people to stand up in their own their own right.
And so, as long as black life doesn't matter, as long as black men are deemed subhuman, or actually, in the case of Darren Wilson, deemed superhuman, as in this Hulk Hogan demonic imitation of Michael Brown, as long as we are viewed as other than human, they have a right to kill us.
Yeah. There's this very simple story, and it was so touching, and thankfully the person wasn't really harmed seriously. There was a young man in September, near the end of September, who was in South Carolina, and the police pulled him over because
a supposed seatbelt violation,
and shot him. But I remember hearing, because it was on video, the young man saying, "What have I done? Why did you shoot me?
Why are you shooting me? Why are you shooting me?" And here's something else, Reverend Alicia. Watch that video very carefully. He goes into the car to get his license and registration in compliance with the instructions of the officer. Okay? He is complying with the officer's request, and the officer opens fire. Then he says from the car, "Why are you shooting me?" Watch the video. He backs out of the car. He's falling backwards. He raises his hands above his head.
His head, yeah.
His hands were up, and the officer continues to shoot.
Yeah.
Watch that video again. So don't tell me it couldn't have happened in Ferguson.
Exactly. But it tugged at my heart to hear this man trying to reason.
Yes.
And
why are you shooting me? Now,
why
we have the blessing.
That?
We have the blessing that he survived.
Yes.
And we also have the blessing of the videotape.
Yes.
So correctly, that officer has already been fired, and charged, and if not convicted already, and then of course will be sued. That's the way to handle this.
Yeah.
You know, why would they?
As someone who deals with people in terms of their thinking and their emotions, and that's what I do as a counselor. And I remember a woman saying to me how afraid she was of black men. It was a white female who said, "I'm afraid of black men because I was robbed one time."
Yes.
And so she's justifying herself. And I said to her, "I was robbed too, but I sleep with a black man."
So it kind of gives you a balanced view.
Yeah, and it was, and so it's exactly. It's about being in relationship and seeing African Americans, people of color, as human beings.
Exactly.
And we are dehumanized at every turn. Yes.
And also to be seen as discrete human beings. That
yes.
I'm not that man that robbed you.
No.
I'm somebody
yes.
else.
Right. But we actually, as much as those who are not people of color don't recognize their bias and error in judgment, many times we don't recognize how in error they are and how biased they are. We're confused, as that young man was on the ground saying, why are you doing this?
Yes, yes, yes.
We don't get it. And I think that it's important to pierce the veil of bias and inability to see
mm-hmm.
to see others as humans and recognize when we're not being seen as human and entitled to simple justice.
Yeah.
And we don't
yeah.
always recognize that that's happening.
I love the way you put that. I, too, have been robbed by a black man, but I sleep with a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, when you speak about relationship, is why I keep coming back to Darren Wilson's lack of relationship with the community that he was supposed to be policing. And
yeah.
that statement should have been the bold headline of an indictment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Darren Wilson, that's not a well-liked community, and they don't like us. What kind
yeah,
of mindset is that to take to work every day when you're carrying a weapon?
Yeah. I have a question, and well, it's more of a statement, and maybe you can comment on it, about the prosecutor being very biased.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the prosecutor a little bit, Robert McCullough?
Yeah.
And his, the person simply says biased, but for me, I remember how he approached his statement in the beginning with enormous judgment against the community. It was so
yes.
disturbing. People said they were surprised the grand jury did not find a reason to prosecute. I'm saying, couldn't you tell the first words out of his mouth?
Oh, yeah, he spoke with such derision.
The most biased statement I've ever heard.
Yes, he spoke with such derision and
oh, my goodness.
And contempt for a community that had been left in the dark, remind you. We
mm-hmm.
did not hear Darren Wilson's account until the transcripts came out. They could have
mm-hmm.
released his account the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had really an interest in the community being calm and being able to weigh both sides, they would have released his statement the next day, but they didn't do that because they needed to coach him and they needed to shape his statement. And so this prosecutor only leaked information that was supportive of Wilson and withheld information that was damaging to Wilson. He didn't want to charge Wilson. He could have charged Wilson from the beginning. You don't always have to go to a grand jury.
Well, say that part again,
because
that people didn't understand that.
Yeah,
you
don't have to always go to a grand jury. The prosecutor could take the case to a preliminary hearing and saying this young man was shot in the street, he's dead, a crime was committed, and we need to charge and to try this person to determine guilt or innocence. And you present
yeah,
that to a judge, and the judge says, yeah, you've got sufficient evidence here. You've got eyewitnesses that saw him with his hands up. You've got audio recording that shows that he was shooting from the moment he stepped out of the car. You know, they could have presented a case very damning against Darren Wilson, but they did not want to.
Okay, very good. I have a caller who has a question, so I want to make sure I've gotten so involved with our conversation.
Yes, and I only have a few minutes left.
Okay, very good. Caller, would you go ahead, please?
I want to
yes.
Reverend Shockley very much for his comments and his in-depth study of this incident. As I have said when I've called before, I'm very grateful for this forum because it is one where you will hear all truth spoken. I have heard all kinds of comments on the national media, some of which have been deeply disturbing, some of which have been very relevant. For instance, on one of the Sunday talk shows, somebody commented that over 60% of the shootings in black communities are black on black crime. And I was so grateful that there was a person of color there who was a respected journalist who spoke up and said that might be true, but over 80% of the killings in white communities are white on white crime. And the point is that because we elected a person of color to the White House, a lot of people hailed this as Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream come true, and we're now in a post-racial society. And a lot of people fail to understand. And they can even look at the attacks on our president and see that not only is racism very much alive and institutionalized, but we're all under attack by this systemic disease. When two little girls who are forced to stand beside their father at the pardoning of a turkey ceremony, and they are attacked quite viciously and disrespectfully, we can look back at the fact that there are other presidents who had children. As a matter of fact, there was a recent president that had two daughters that were a little wild, but nobody ever disrespected them this way. But these are black kids. So what? So what if they live in the White House? The point is that racism is very much alive. And as Reverend Shockley pointed out, in this particular community, you have a police force that is overwhelmingly white. I think they might have like three black officers, and a community that is definitely at least 75%, maybe 80% black. And, you know, the point is we've seen the difference in that makeup here in the Washington area when we had a police force here in metropolitan D.C., in the District of Columbia itself, and most infamously in Prince George's County. When those officers were predominantly white and they policed areas that were predominantly, there were far more incidents of this type of brutality, this type of unprofessional behavior.
Well,
it makes a big difference. Makes a big difference. Thank you.
Thank
Reverend Shockley. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
For your comments.
Reverend Alicia, thank you so much for having me on your broadcast. I look forward to returning another time.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. It's been helpful, and I will definitely be calling you back. I'm going to say good night to you, and hopefully we'll have more comments and things to talk about in terms of what we can do in the future. So that's what we need to have you come back and talk about, Reverend Shockley. Thank you. Thank you. We have been so blessed this evening to have this opportunity to have a dialogue with Reverend Madison Shockley. You know, listeners, many believe that the word religion comes from the Latin word religare, which means to tie or to bind. And religion should help us tie and bind the fragments of life together. But all too often, religion encourages us to overlook, ignore, discard, or deny the injustices that breaks us apart at the center of our lives. Instead of enabling us to bind the wounds that break our hearts and our spirits, at times religion can bind us to practices and customs that injure us or worse than that, silence us. If we as a people are empowered by religion, by being joined and tied to our higher power, we could then break the chains that bind us. Just think about that. That being tied to religion should empower us to break the chains that bind us. I for one, believe that Michael Brown's story is not an isolated story of injustice. His story, as we heard from Reverend Shockley, his story is merely one of the many painful sagas that is at this time serving to awaken people, particularly those who are concerned about oppression and injustice. In this Advent season, I'm heartened by the people of goodwill rising up and crying out, Black Lives Matter. People of faith praying for justice and taking a stand in protest against the grand jury's findings. And religious leaders like Madison Shockley and so many others who are speaking out and helping all of us to do an analysis with integrity, an analysis that is tied to a social justice paradigm, one that honors the ties that bind us to our higher power, the ties that bind us to God Almighty and to Jesus who is the Christ, the ties that bind us to one another. Yes, beloved, faith leaders are praying, and we are also analyzing in God's name. Thanks for listening tonight. And until next week, remember to rev up, accelerate, and energize your life. Rev up, accelerate, and energize your life.